handout, but I thought there'd be too many sections to remember otherwise.
So the title is John Knox, like 1514 approximately to 1572, His Life and Greatness. So what I'm intending to do is to go through the life of John Knox chronologically, so unlike the talk on the Reformation, and then the last section, section 9, to make some general remarks about his character and so on. His life falls naturally into distinct periods. He had a pretty adventurous life. I think almost any one of period of his life would be as much adventurous, I think the rest of us would expect in our entire lives, but it falls into these distinct periods, and I've grouped them together into 8 pieces for convenience. So I'm not going to spend the same length of time on each one of them. I've found some of them more interesting than others, so I'll spend more time on the ones that I found more interesting. So firstly, the early years and George Wisher. So this is the years 1514 to 1546. So Knox was born about 1514, no one knows for sure, but that's the date, 1513, 1514, that's accepted nowadays. And he was probably born at Gifford Gate in Haddington. Again, seems to be the favoured location, east of Edinburgh. Sure, I should say that there's not much known about Knox's early life. That was where he was born. He studied at St Andrews. Again, for some reason he didn't graduate there, but that seems to be where he studied. And he was ordained priest, probably in 1536. So he was a Roman Catholic priest. But, as I was saying earlier, there were Roman Catholic priests all over the place. He didn't seem to have a charge exactly. And he turns up in the early 1540s acting as a notary in Haddington, witnessing signatures. So perhaps someone can tell me later what a notary does. I'd be interested to know. A notarial writer? That's what he was acting as. And apparently it was regarded as a position of considerable responsibility. And he was also a private tutor at that stage. Then in 1542, James V died, leaving a 6-year-old Mary, Queen of Scots, and the Earl of Arran was appointed regent. And as I mentioned earlier, in 1542, for some reason, the Earl of Arran was temporarily, as it were, a Protestant, supported the Reformed faith, and he allowed the reading of the Bible in English, perhaps that came slightly earlier, and he appointed 2 Reformed preachers as his chaplains. And it was through one of these, Thomas Williams, probably through one of these, that John Knox was converted. So this would be when he was aged about 28. Then Thomas Williams disappears off the scene, and George Wishart comes back to Scotland. And Knox became a follower of his and a sword bearer. So this is really all that's known about this early part of Knox's life. As I say, he was brought up in the Roman Catholic faith. At some point he came under the sound of the gospel, he believed and was converted and became a follower of George Wishart. And the night before George Wishart was arrested, he dismissed Knox, who wished to accompany him, with the well-known words, return to your bairns and God bless you. Return to these children that you're acting as tutor for and God bless you. One is sufficient for a sacrifice. So Wishart was arrested in December 1545 and was burned in St Andrews the following May by Cardinal Beaton. So that was the 1st of May 1546. And on the 29th of May, this brings us on to section 2, Knox in St Andrews. On the 29th of May, Norman Leslie and various others broke into St Andrews Castle, assassinated the Cardinal, who had been responsible for the burning of George Wishart, and took possession of the castle. And Knox gives a fascinating account of the various steps of their breaking in and how they had to overcome certain people and what they saw. So that was the 29th of May, and they held the castle. Having broken into the castle, they then kept possession of it in the face of various sieges, and other Protestants started to join them. Knox had been in danger after the arrest of Wishart, and in April of the following year, he decided the safest thing for him to do was to go into the castle at St. Andrews, along with the children that he was acting as tutor for. So he joined the castle, he went into the castle, and he catechized the children. Things are a bit strange. Although the castle was besieged, or from time to time was besieged, they used to go out and have services in the church, so it was a rather half-hearted siege. And Knox used to catechize the children in the parish church of St. Andrews. And after about 6 weeks of this, it became evident that Knox had a great gift for instruction. And the people in the congregation in the castle had a meeting, and they decided to call Knox as their minister. And on the appointed day, John Rough, who was himself a preacher, but not nearly as able as Knox, the appointed day, John Rough preached a sermon on the election of ministers, and then he turned to John Knox and told him, in the name of those who called him, to take upon him the office of preaching, if he wished to avoid God's displeasure. Whereat, the said John, abashed, burst forth in most abundant tears, and withdrew himself to his chamber. His countenance and behaviour from that day till the day that he was compelled to present himself to the public place of preaching did sufficiently declare the grief and trouble of his heart. That's Knox's call to the ministry, and you can see how solemnly he regarded the whole matter. And one reason, obviously, for that is that he was thinking of what had happened to George Wishart, that this was really his call to potentially to follow in the steps of George Wishart. But notwithstanding his reluctance, he recognised that this was his duty, and his first public sermon was preached in the parish church of St. Andrews, and it was preached to help John Rough, who had been in conflict with a Roman Catholic priest and was getting the worst of it. And John Knox joined in, and his first public sermon was on Daniel 7, verses 24 and 25. Daniel 7 is the fourth beast, and 24 and 25 are the 10 horns, and then one of the little horns that was diverse from the others and thought to change times and seasons. And Knox identified this with Rome, and making the connection with Rome, this is a significant thing, made the connection with Rome, and therefore if Rome is identified with this fourth beast and this little horn, then one should have nothing to do with Rome. It's certainly not going to be successful in reforming Rome. And the comment of the people of St. Andrews was that whereas the previous reformers had only snedded the branches of papistry, that he struck boldly at the root to destroy the whole. So right from the very start, he was acknowledged as an exceptionally powerful preacher. But his ministry in the castle was brief, because in July, so that's only 2 months after he got into the castle, in July a fleet of French galleys came and besieged the castle, and the galleys had cannons, they set up successfully, started knocking down the wall of the castle, and the castle was obliged to surrender. And so Knox was captured and put to work as a galley slave. One thing I meant to say before, and came to mind in the question time, was we have to understand this whole period of history, the close connection between Scotland and France. So from a Scottish perspective, the French are allies, generally speaking, and there's all sorts of coming and going between France and Scotland, these French galleys, whereas the English are enemies, basically. That's the ordinary perspective of the time. So Knox was imprisoned in a French galley, and that was what they generally did with their religious prisoners. They put them to work in the galleys. So this brings us to the third thing, which is Knox in the galleys. And the life of a galley slave was unimaginably hard and unpleasant. Hard physical work when they were having to row, a lot of beating and so on. Extreme discomfort, exposed to the weather, the cold in the winter, the heat in the summer, little food and frequent cruelty. And it damaged Knox's health for the rest of his life. In his history, he doesn't say a great deal about it, but he talks about the torment that he sustained and the sobs of his heart. And this was the Lord's way of preparing him for the great work that lay ahead of him. But it also meant that he was able to learn or to perfect his French. Perhaps he knew a bit of French anyway from this contact between France and Scotland, but many of his fellow galley slaves would probably have been French Huguenots, French Protestants. So the result of his 19 months in the galleys was that he appears to be fluent in French. And this was an ability that was useful to him later on when he preached in France on various occasions, as we will see. So you have to think of Knox as being an accomplished French speaker. Now the galley slaves spent the winter of 1547 in Nantes on the Loire, just sort of sitting. I think it doesn't seem that they did very much in the winter. And here attempts were made to compel them to worship the Virgin Mary. Knox has a story about a Scot, who's generally thought to be himself, who when they put the image of the Virgin Mary into his hands, and he was supposed to kiss it, and he looked cannily around to see whether anyone was paying attention, and when he thought they weren't, he threw it into the river, saying, "Let Our Lady save herself. She is light enough, let her learn to swim." He says after that they didn't trouble the Scots anymore with these images of the Virgin Mary. And in April of the following year, 1548, they rowed up to Brest, where they were joined with other galleys, and they collected a French army, which they transported to Scotland. So that must have been a galling business for Knox, having to row this French army to Scotland. And they spent June to September on the east coast around St. Andrews. Knox was very sick at this stage, not surprisingly, given the conditions that he was living in. And at one point, when the galley was somewhere between Dundee and St. Andrews, a friend asked him if he knew what land they were next to. I suppose he was wondering just how feverish he was. And Knox replied, "I know it well, for I see the steeple of the place where God first in public opened my mouth to his glory. And I am fully persuaded, how weak that ever I now am, that I shall not depart this life till that my tongue shall glorify his godly name in the same place." That was in about April 1548. Then they returned to France, and they returned to France rather in September, to the north of France this time, to Rouen, which is on the Seine, for the winter. And in the castle at Rouen, there was another reformer from St. Andrew's Castle, a man called Henry Balnaves, who'd been captured at the same time. And the more noble prisoners were put in castles, and the lower ones were put in the galleys. So Henry Balnaves is in the castle, Knox is in the galley, and there were sufficient Protestants and sufficient communication between the castle and the galleys that they were able to bring a treatise which Balnaves had written on justification by faith. They were able to bring this treatise to Knox in the galleys, and he there revised the treatise and wrote a preface for it, and it was sent to Scotland. Well, by this time Edward VI had come to the throne in England, and it's presumed that it was through English intercession that John Knox was released from the galleys in February 1549. And he went to England. So that was his 19 months in the galleys. Then, so this brings us to section 4, which is his time in England, 1549 to 1554. Now, in England, he spent the first 2 years as a minister in Berwick. He was sent up to Eric. There was a long list of the Protestant preachers that were available in England. I think about 80 names on it. They were short of ministers. Edward was short of ministers, and John Rough and the Thomas Gwillam that we mentioned, they appear on that list. And Knox was among those who were available for supplying these different parts of England. So he was sent up to Berwick. 2 years in Berwick, then 2 years in Newcastle, and then a year in London as a royal chaplain. And in Berwick, he formed what was the first Puritan congregation in England. This is the beginning, actually, of English Puritanism, is John Knox. Quite a satisfying thing for Scottish people. Don't you think, Mr. Roth? So the first English Puritan congregation was formed in Berwick under John Knox, conducting worship according to the biblical pattern. It was a difficult situation. England and Scotland were at war at the time, and the place was full of waves of soldiers, unruly soldiers, coming to Berwick on the border, passing through to Scotland. Many of these soldiers, of course, were Papists and soldiers, men used to fighting. And Berwick was a troubled place at the time. But Knox's ministry had a blessed effect. It pointed out that Knox is fond of military illustrations in his sermons and was able, in that respect, to appeal to the soldiers. And the effect of Knox's ministry was to bring peace to the town, and there was a great blessing, really. And he also, while he was there, he met his first wife, Marjorie Bowes, an English woman. It's not known exactly when they were married, probably quite a bit later, but it was in the time that he was in Berwick that he met her. So that was Knox in Berwick, and then 2 years later, 1551, he moved to Newcastle, a bit further south, where he preached again with similar blessings. And then, because of his fame, all the while the people were hearing him and his fame as a preacher was increasing, in 1552 he was appointed a royal chaplain. One of Edward VI had six chaplains appointed, and Knox was one of them. And after a while he was brought down from Newcastle to London. Now, one issue that arose at the end of 1552 was over kneeling at communion. The Book of Common Prayer, the English Book of Common Prayer, was being rewritten, and the Church of England was becoming more reformed, more Protestant. Various Roman Catholic practices were being purged out. And one of the issues then was over kneeling at communion, which Knox detested. And he was administering communion in Berwick with people sitting in the practice, that's the way it's always been done in Scotland. So the Book of Common Prayer was being revised, and indeed had already received the approval of Parliament, and had gone to the printers, and copies were starting to appear in public. And it was at this stage that Knox was down in London, and he preached a sermon before the king on the evil of kneeling at communion, the danger of idolatry, the inappropriateness, the unscripturalness of it. And he also put in a written complaint. And Thomas Cranmer, who was responsible for the book, largely, was rather annoyed for various reasons, particularly because the book had been through Parliament and now this private person which was suggesting revisions. But notwithstanding this, Knox had sufficient influence that first of all the printing of the book was stopped, and then there was quite a bit of discussion, and the end of it was that a little note, a little slip, was inserted in the book. Knox didn't win completely. I mean, they carried on with the kneeling at communion, but a little slip was printed in a different colour, called the black rubric. It was printed in black, and it explained that kneeling at communion does not imply adoration of the elements, and that the bread and the wine remain in their natural substances, and that the adoration of them is idolatry to be abhorred of all faithful Christians. So that's what the black rubric says. So that the insertion of that was a consequence, as far as we can understand, of Knox's sermon. So it's a significant influence that he had at the time. And this was pasted into the remaining copies of the Book of Common Prayer. And apparently, if you look at, get hold of these, the surviving copies, the first edition of the 1552 Book of Common Prayer, you will see that some of them have the black rubric and some of them don't. This black rubric was subsequently taken out by Elizabeth, who was, one might say, much more high church and inclined to the adoration of the elements and that sort of thing. It was taken out in 1559, but it was restored under Charles II in the 1662 Book of Common Prayer to sort of placate the English Puritans, and it is there to this day. And it's a stumbling block, has been a stumbling block to the Anglo-Catholics. It's the only thing in the Book of Common Prayer that explicitly forbids the worshipping of the elements. The rubric says that the kneeling does not imply the adoration of the elements, that they remain in their natural substances, and the adoration of them is idolatry. So that is one of Knox's contributions to the Church of England, a significant victory for him. In 1553, he was offered the bishopric of Rochester, but he declined. By this time, Edward VI's health, I think, was probably starting to appear weak, and there was some fear over his death. And I think Knox realised that one didn't wish to be Bishop of Rochester in these circumstances with Mary as the heir to the throne, apart from any other views that he had of bishops, and that was certainly one of the reasons. But in the summer of that year, Edward died, Mary came to the throne. Knox remained in England for a while. Some people went left more rapidly than he did, but he could see that he couldn't do any good there. And so with many others, he fled to the continent at the beginning of 1554. That takes us on to number 5, Dieppe, Frankfurt and Geneva. So in January 1554, he came to Dieppe. I want to say a bit more about Dieppe later on. Then he went to Geneva, then Dieppe, then Geneva, then Dieppe, then Geneva. And he was always coming back to Dieppe, trying to get news of Scotland, because that was the port where the news came to. In Geneva, he learned Hebrew. He'd long wanted to learn Hebrew, but this was his opportunity. Apparently he was rather proud of his Hebrew thereafter. And at the end of 1554, he was called to be the pastor of the Congregation of British Exiles in Frankfurt. His time in Frankfurt was brief, and it's what's known as the so-called Frankfurt Troubles, because the issue surfaced there of this conflict between Anglicanism and Puritanism. Knox and others set up a Puritan worship among the exiles. Richard Cox and others arrived. Richard Cox was later a bishop. Richard Cox arrived, and he insisted that the exiles must follow the Book of Common Prayer, an English church, and it should have an English face. In particular, they must kneel at communion. But Knox was prepared to tolerate Anglican worship if it was required by a broadly Protestant magistrate, as in England. But it was not so required in Frankfurt, and he was not, in those circumstances, prepared to tolerate it. He preached fiercely against the faults of the Book of Common Prayer, but otherwise behaved in a remarkably peaceful way, given his reputation. His behaviour belies his reputation. And the Coxians and the Knoxians were at war, and the Coxians got their way, rather shamefully, by drawing the attention of the magistrates of Frankfurt to something that Knox had written in England, comparing the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, to Nero. Now, that was all right in England, but in Frankfurt, which was an imperial city, you're comparing the ruler to Nero, and the magistrates thought in these circumstances, given it was brought to their attention, they could hardly ignore it, and therefore they felt it wisest to expel Knox. But that was hardly upright way of the Coxians to get rid of Knox. So Knox left Frankfurt and went to Geneva. Now after this, he returned to Scotland for 9 months, September 1555 to June 1556, via Dieppe, for a very significant preaching tour. And as he went round, numerous people were converted or strengthened in their faith, among whom were two important figures later on, Regent Murray, as he became later, and also the Earl of Argyll. So these were powerful noblemen, who were to be of great significance later on in the establishing of the Reformation, and that they were converted or brought forward as a result of that visit to Scotland. And at the same time, there was an important discussion on whether it was right for Protestants to attend the Mass. And there was a debate, and Knox won. One man said that after debating on this subject with Knox, they were pretending, they were dissembling, they would go to the Mass just for their own safety. One man said afterwards, to argue with Knox is like a foretaste of Judgment Day. We see perfectly that our shifts will serve nothing before God, seeing they stand us in so small stead before man. Their excuses were useless. That was an important step towards the formation of the Reformed Church. They were now separate. They were now fully meeting separately as a result of Knox's visit. Then he was called back to Geneva to become the pastor of the exiled congregation there, along with Christopher Goodman. And then followed the most peaceful period of his life for about a year and a half. There was a Puritan congregation, he was the pastor, he had now had his wife with him, they had two sons who were born out in Geneva, and that's really the only peaceful period of Knox's whole life, was these golden days in Geneva. In the autumn of 1557, he heard that the Reformation was advancing rapidly in Scotland, and he received an invitation to go back there, but when he got to Dieppe, hoping to sail to Scotland, he was the news changed, he was told that all those people that had called him had now gone cold again, and he was advised to delay. And while there, he wrote his famous first blast of the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women, against the ruling of Mary of Guise and Mary in England. And then he returned to Geneva, where he published it. Calvin wasn't too pleased. He went back to Geneva, so he was in Dieppe in the north of France, and there was a war in the north, so he went to Geneva the long way around, went round to La Rochelle, where he preached in French and baptised a child, probably a Scots exile, then down to Lyon, and it's thought possible, probable on this journey, that he would have visited Poitiers, because that was sort of en route. And the significant thing there is that at Poitiers, the leading French pastors of the Reformed Church were gathered together to draw up the French Confession and their Book of Discipline. Knox would certainly have known about it because of these close contacts between the British exiles and the French Huguenots, so he'd have known that they were meeting, and he would very likely have gone by. And as he'd recently been drawing up a confession and a Book of Discipline in Frankfurt and Geneva, it's the sort of thing that his advice might have been welcome. So there's nothing certain there, but it's likely, or possible at least, that Knox had a hand in the French Confession, the French Book of Discipline. Now in February 1559, he again heard how things were moving in Scotland, and again he returned to Dieppe. And he was hoping to travel to Scotland through England to visit his people in Newcastle and Berwick. But he sent people to England to ask for permission, but Queen Elizabeth was smarting over the first blast of the trumpet, and she nearly put the people in prison who had been sent to ask permission for Knox. She certainly didn't give permission, so the permission to travel through England was not forthcoming. So for several months he was left chafing in Dieppe, waiting for the permission, which never came. But this delay turned out to be significant for the Protestant Church in Dieppe. When he first went there in 1551, which is before Knox first went there, it said there was not a single Protestant in Dieppe. That's recorded, wasn't it? In 1551, there was not a single Protestant in Dieppe. And I think Knox first went there in 1554, that's right. So there might have been a few Protestants then. But the number had been growing, and Knox had mentioned, I think this was about the seventh visit to Dieppe, He probably preached on every occasion that he'd been there. Remember, he could preach in French. And the congregation was increasing in Dieppe. And during Knox's enforced delay, he preached to the congregation, which grew dramatically under the powerful ministry of Knox, so much so that they now started meeting publicly in the daytime, which they hadn't dared to do before. And indeed, a month after his departure, they openly celebrated the Lord's Supper in the daytime with a congregation of 600 to 800 people, including the captain of the castle and some of the most notable people in the town. And so the result of that was that Dieppe, from being a place where there were no Protestants at all, became a Protestant stronghold in France. One of the, along with La Rochelle, it was one of the Protestant strongholds, and it continued to be so in spite of intense persecution really for the next 60 years or so. So just his enforced delay for a few months and the power of his preaching and the blessing that accompanied that brought a blessing to the French church there in Dieppe. Well, this brings us then to number 6, which is the Reformation in Scotland, 1559 to 1561. This is the most exciting period of Knox's life. He finally returned to Scotland on the 2nd of May, 1559. There was a Roman Catholic reforming council sitting in Edinburgh at the time, thinking about the deplorable state of the Roman Church and what they could do about it. Now, the things that they were proposing to do about it are not sufficiently, I mean, they're laughable, they're pathetic reforms that they were proposing, but they're not even respectable enough to quote. And a messenger came to this council and informed them that Knox was back in Scotland and had spent the last night in Leith. And it's an indication of the extraordinary reputation that he had by this time that the council immediately broke up in disarray and departed. Several of the Protestant ministers had been summoned to appear before the Queen Regent, Mary of Guise. They'd been charged with offences, with illegal preaching, and they were due to appear before her in Stirling on the 10th of May. So Knox, being Knox, said he would come along too. He was already condemned in his absence from his visit in 1555. It was a bit of negotiating, and it was agreed with the Queen Regent that the ministers didn't have to appear after all. So they didn't appear, and then she was so devious that because they didn't appear, they were then condemned in their absence. But the next day, on the 11th of May, Knox preached in St. John's Church in Perth, firstly on the subject of keeping faith and the way in which the Queen Regent had broken faith, but also on the idolatry of the Mass. The congregation was quietly dispersing afterwards when a priest defiantly uncovered an altar to say Mass. And the little boy complained that this was wrong after a sermon which had been exposing the evil of idolatry. The priest struck him a blow, whereupon the boy threw a stone at the altar, which happened to break an image. And that this led to a great riot. The wrathful multitude destroyed all the images in the church and then went off to sack the two monasteries. That was where you gave an account of what they found in one of those monasteries. So that was Perth reformed. So then Knox proceeded towards St. Andrews, intending to preach there. And Archbishop Hamilton of St. Andrews, one of the leading Roman Catholics, sent Knox a warning message. And in his history, most of this is taken from Knox's history, and in the margin of his history he has a little note about this warning message. It says, "The bishop, his good mind towards John Knox." And then the message, that in case John Knox should present himself to the preaching place in this town and the principal church, he, the Archbishop, will arrange for him to be saluted with a dozen muskets, whereof the most part should light upon his nose. So the reformers were uncertain what to do after this warning, but Knox was determined that he was going to continue to St. Andrews. And this is typical of Knox, and I feel this is a part of the power of the Reformation. So Knox had this mentality, if one thought, we call it that, that really Patrick Hamilton had had, and Wishart had had, that you go ahead. Your life is threatened, you go ahead. And that's what he did. So he went to St. Andrews, whether these muskets would be fired at him or not, and in the event there was no opposition. So he preached in St. Andrews, a rather lukewarm audience to start with, but he won them round, and that town was reformed as well. And soon afterwards, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Stirling, and other towns also were destroying their monuments and adopting the Reformation. So the Reformation continued to advance with various setbacks. There was a major setback in November 1559 when the French army, the Queen Regent with her French army, they'd been besieged in Leith. They broke out, so got into Edinburgh, they scattered the reformers who fled to Stirling, complete disarray and demoralised. Knox preached a famous sermon in Stirling on Psalm 80, verses 4 to 8. O Lord God of hosts, how long wilt thou be angry against the prayer of thy people? And he drew attention to their sins. He said, the reason this disaster has happened is not because of the weakness of the Reformation or of God, but because of your sins. That's why God is angry with the prayers of his people, and that they were to be humbled for their sins. And Thomas Randolph, who was the English ambassador, who was with the reformers, said that the voice of one man is able in 1 hour to put more life into us than 500 trumpets continually blustering in our ears. So the effect of his sermon was that they recovered their morale and pressed on and carried on with the work of the Reformation. So that takes us through to the Treaty of Edinburgh on the 6th of July 1560, which we mentioned. The French troops withdrew, the triumph of Protestantism, the Reformation Parliament, the abolition of papal authority in the Mass on the 24th of August. But Knox is now faced with something which no one else has been faced with in modern history, I don't think. And that was the question, what form exactly is the new religion in Scotland going to take? You've won now, you've got the Parliament, it's not going to be Romanism. How is it going to be organised? How is worship going to be conducted? What is the creed of the church going to be? And what is your structure? What's the relationship between the church and the state? And these are fundamental questions, absolutely fundamental questions, and obviously others than Knox were involved in making the decision, but he was no doubt the principal figure. And he was being asked to do something that I think no one had done before. Calvin had been in a similar position, but only with regard to Geneva, one tiny city, whereas Knox had it for the whole country. And the French Reformed Church, well, they too were deciding their policy, their organisation, but they were a persecuted minority, not a successful majority. So Knox, as we say, was asked to do something that no one else had done. Well, the question of worship was easy. They simply adopted the form of worship that they'd had in Geneva, the so-called Book of Common Order, with very minor alterations. The Confession of Faith, too, was rapidly drawn up by the six Johns, John Knox, John Willock, John Winram, John Erskine, John Rowe, John Spottiswood, was ratified by Parliament. It was along the lines of the other Reformed confessions, but had its typically Knoxian vigour. And the other thing that they drew up was the First Book of Discipline, again prepared remarkably quickly, and the suggestion is that Knox probably had come from France with a copy of their First Book of Discipline with him, and therefore was ready when faced with a question of what we should have in Scotland. So that's the First Book of Discipline describes the arrangements of the church. So thereafter, all these things were then adopted. The First Book of Discipline, not really adopted by the Parliament, but the other things were adopted. And now, the Reformation, it becomes a matter of implementing these things. And the first General Assembly of the Church met in December 1560. Brings us on to section 7, which is fairly brief. So this is Knox and Mary, 1561 to 1567. This is This section is very political and complicated, and I really want to skip over it. After the triumph of the year of 1560, it comes as something of an anticlimax. Now the struggle begins with Mary. Mary, Queen of Scots, returned to Scotland in August 1561, determined, if possible, to reintroduce Romanism, and set up her mass in Holyrood. That was the first, within a week she'd done that. That was the first issue. Now all these nobles and so on, who'd been so keen to see the back of Rome, were put to the test. Where were they really? Were they hot for the Protestant religion? Or now they got their money, were they satisfied? So there's the cooling off of the nobles, who supported the reformed cause, the effect of Mary's charms and subtlety, interviews with Knox. After one interview with her, Knox said that if there be not in her a proud mind, a crafty wit, and an endurate, a hard heart against God and his truth, my judgment faileth me. That was Knox's judgment, and he was much shrewder in this sort of thing than many of the other people. So that she was eventually imprisoned in Lochleven Castle, June 1567, and the young James VI became king. But just from this period, I wanted to read you something different. Knox at this stage was the minister of St. Giles, living in John Knox's house on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. His wife had died in 1560, Marjorie Bowes. They were only married for a few years. In 1564, he remarried Margaret Stuart, who was very much younger than he was. She was 17 and he was 50. And the marriage excited some comment. Here is a Roman Catholic account, a popish account of his courtship. Gives you some idea of the sort of abuse that Knox had to live with all his life, really, and which has attached his name ever since. A Roman Catholic version of Knox's courtship. Having laid aside all fear of the pains of hell, and regarding nothing the honesty of the world, as a bondslave of the devil, being kindled with an unquenchable lust and ambition, he did pursue to have alliance with the honourable House of Ochiltree, that was the house that his new wife belonged to, of the King's Majesty's own blood, riding there within great court, on a trim gelding, not like a prophet or an old decrepit priest, as he was, but like as he'd been of the blood royal, with his bands of taffety fastened with golden rings and precious stones, and as is plainly reported in the country, by sorcery and witchcraft, did so allure that poor gentlewoman that she could not live without him, which appears to be a great probability, she being a damsel of noble blood, and he a decrepit old creature of most base degree of any that could be found in the country. Because as a matter of fact, it was a very happy marriage. They had three daughters, one of whom subsequently became the wife of John Welsh of Ayr. That was that period of Knox's life. Section 8, the final years. In October 1570, at the age of 56, he had a stroke, a partial anterior circulation stroke affecting the left cortex, I'm told, and he lost the use of speech for a while. He recovered and was able to resume preaching, but he never got back his full strength. Now in 1571 there was a civil war in Scotland. The Queen's party got sufficient strength to really start a war, and Knox had to leave Edinburgh for his own safety. There had been an assassination attempt, a musket fired in through the window of John Knox's house, and he retired to St Andrews, where once again he was preaching on Daniel. Remember, that was his very first sermon in St Andrews, was on Daniel 7. This time he was on Daniel 11. At this stage he had to walk with a stick and with a servant holding his arm, and he had to be lifted into the pulpit. But James Melville tells us, the passage that was referred to earlier, that in the opening up of his text he was moderate for the space of half an hour, but when he entered to application, he made me so to tremble that I could not hold a pen to write. He behoved at the first entry into the pulpit, he behoved to lean, he had to prop himself up at the first entry into the pulpit. Ere he had done with his sermon, he was so active and vigorous that he was like to ding the pulpit into blads and to fly out of it. Returned to Edinburgh in August 1572, but his health was rapidly declining. His final sermon was on the 9th of November, at the admission of his successor to St Giles, James Lawson. And after that he had a fortnight's deathbed with many visitors. And one temptation that he had at this time was to congratulate himself on all that he'd done during his life. One gentlewoman who came to visit him feared God, desiring him to praise God for that he had been. And so began, as it were, to praise him. And he said, "Tongue, tongue, lady, the flesh of itself is overproud, and needs no means to esteem the self." And therefore he protested that he did only claim the free mercy of God, shed unto mankind in the blood of his dear Son, Jesus Christ, and willed her never to puff up flesh, which of itself was too prone and ready to do the same, without any other provocation, and so exhorted her unto humility, and to cast away pride, and desired her to remember the words of a woman spoken to her long ago, saying, "Lady, lady, the black one, Satan, the black one has never yet tramped upon your foot." Every day he had to him read to him Isaiah 53 and John 17, which he described as the place where he first cast anchor, and he also had Calvin's sermons on Ephesians in French read to him, another indication of how easy he found French. He died on the Monday the 24th of November 1572 at the early age of 58, and he was buried in the graveyard behind St Giles, and that graveyard was obliterated when Parliament House was built in 1633, and there was a gravestone, sort of stone marking his burying place, which I gather was removed by the Edinburgh Council in the 1960s, so that his place of burial is now unmarked. So finally, Knox the man. A little bit on his appearance. There's only one engraving of him which is regarded as authentic. I should have included it on the handout, but I didn't think to do that. But it doesn't really give you much of an idea of his appearance. And there's also a detailed description, but again, it doesn't... I'll read it to you, but... "In bodily stature, he was rather below the normal height. His limbs were straight and well-proportioned, his shoulders broad, his fingers somewhat long, his head was of medium size with black hair, his appearance swarthy, yet not unpleasant, his countenance, which was grave and stern, though not harsh, wore a natural dignity and air of authority. In anger, his very frown became imperious. Under a rather narrow forehead, his eyebrows rose in a dense ridge. His cheeks were ruddy and somewhat full, so that it seemed as though his eyes receded into hollows. The eyes themselves were dark blue, keen and animated. His face was somewhat long, with a long nose, a full mouth, and large lips, of which the upper one was slightly the thicker. His beard was black, flecked with grey, thick, and falling down a hand and a half long." His appearance, his character and abilities, well, this is just my own views. He was bold, determined, confident, inclined to be overly rough with his opponents, but gentle towards his family and his flock, an exceptionally powerful preacher. Wherever he went, he was the first choice. St Andrew, Berwick, Newcastle, Frankfurt, Geneva, St Giles, the principal pulpit in Scotland, he was always the first choice. He was eloquent and ready in debate, an exceptionally shrewd judge of character and of situations, a natural leader, clever man and some scholarly abilities, they're not sort of in the league of Calvin and Melvin and people like that. And as a Christian, he was brave, he was a man of great faith, and he was deeply biblical in his outlook. That's one thing that comes across. He's always got the biblical view on what's happening. And he had broad sympathies and a good understanding of the human heart and life. I'm afraid I want to read one more thing. Mr. Chem. This is an illustration. This is Knox talking about himself, and I think this is quite interesting in the light of all the criticism of him down the centuries. This is a letter to his mother-in-law. He wrote a lot to his mother-in-law about spiritual things, Mrs. Bowes. It's an interesting one for preachers, this, actually, as well. "Because although I never lacked the presence and the plain image of my own wretched infirmity, yet seeing sin so manifestly abound in all estates, I am compelled to thunder out the threatenings of God against obstinate rebels. In doing whereof, although, as God knoweth, I am no malicious or obstinate sinner, I sometimes am wounded, knowing myself criminal and guilty in many, yea, in all things, malicious obstinacy they decide, but in other I reprehend. So what he's saying is that he's obliged to denounce these things, but he is aware that he's guilty of them to a degree himself. He says, judge not, mother, that I write these things debasing myself, other than I am. No, I am worse than my pen can express. In body, you think I am no adulterer. Let so be, but the heart is infected with foul lusts, and will lust, albeit I lament ever so much. Externally, I commit no adultery. I think that's saying, I think this means that I'm an idolatry. Yeah? Externally, I commit no idolatry, but my wicked heart loveth the self, and cannot be refrained from vain imaginations, yea, not from such as are the fountain of all idolatry. I am no man-killer with my hands, but I help not my needy brother so liberally as I may and ought. I steal not horse, money, nor clothes from my neighbour, but that small portion of worldly substance I bestow not so lightly as God's holy law requires. I bear no false witness against my neighbour, or judgment, or otherwise, before men, but I speak not the truth of God so boldly as it becometh his true messenger to do. And thus, in conclusion, there is no vice repugning to God's holy will, expressed in his law, wherewith my heart is not infected. So he knew his own heart. His writings, not much to say there. I think this is the first class that we've mentioned. His main doctrinal thing was a treatise on predestination. There's one sermon that was published. The spiritual letters to Mrs. Bowes. General letters of exhortation. That in a way was his main work, and also his history. He was hated in his life and ever since, and I think it's an interesting question, a curious question as to why Knox has been so much hated. I would suggest that it's for his Christian qualities and for his history that he wrote. And lastly, his achievements. So among these, we've mentioned the establishing of Protestant congregations in St. Andrews, the start of his ministry, that was significant, Berwick, Dieppe, the foundation of English Puritanism, with all that that entails, you think of John Owen and so on, if you trace it all back, try to trace it back, you come back to Knox. His views on government, the duties of rulers and the rights of subjects, and modern views in this respect, they just have to bow to the whim of the king and the queen. And the launching of the Reformed Church of Scotland, setting that church in the right direction with the Book of Common Order and the Catechism and the Scots Confession and the First Book of Discipline. So he was the principal instrument that God used in the Scottish Reformation, standing head and shoulders above the rest. And we should be thankful to the Most High for John Knox and for his legacy.
Thank you, Dr.